Infowars.com/show.
Something happened on X where they started cross-posting Japanese posts with American posts and inspired me to go back to 2019, do a little highlight video of my time in Japan. Probably the best 2 weeks of my life. It was freaking amazing. I love Japan. It was a great place. And I'd love to live there. I think it would be a great place to live. You know what I would never do? You know what I would never do to the Japanese people whom I respect and admire? I would never break into their country and live there against their will and then file a court case when they try to tell me to go home. Because I'm a decent person that actually appreciates Japan and would want to contribute to it, not be a parasite and a burden. I don't know why we don't get that level of respect from anybody else around the world, but it's not too much to ask. And yet, it's constantly withheld from us that just basic respect, basic appreciation of the desires and the will of the American people. You would think, if anybody, you would think they'd be welcoming me with open arms. Guess what? They don't have to. And I respect that because I like them. And anybody that doesn't respect that doesn't like us and doesn't belong here. So I thought I'd play that a little bit. Thought I actually did a pretty good job while also not using a single image that showed my wife's face. It was difficult. Would have been a lot better if I could have shown her face. But again, this is the basics of the conflict here in America, is that for some reason, we just allow ourselves to be disrespected, allow ourselves to be taken advantage of. We allow people who don't like us, don't want to contribute to us, literally just see us as a giant bunch of suckers to scam to the nth degree, and they want to come here to scam us and then send all their money back home. Why would we ever allow this? And this is the thing. Right now, the Supreme Court is debating birthright citizenship. Birthright citizenship is absurd. It's absurd on the face of it. It may have had a role to play back in the 1800s when it was first implemented. And this is why this whole thing is nonsensical, is because these arguments, I get how the law works. I understand why we do things this way. It seems like a vestigial, like, holdover of an earlier time where maybe this would have made sense. But right now, it's like the question is simple to me. Should somebody be allowed to enter our country, plop out a baby, and they are therefore American? The answer should be absolutely not. What the hell are you talking about? That's ridiculous. Of course not. How would that even work? Are you crazy? There are just 7 billion people that can get here in a plane flight. They can all just stop over for an afternoon, have a baby at our expense, and then that baby can just collect Social Security, vote in our elections. I mean, this is absurd, right? But you can't just look at a problem as it exists right now and provide a solution for it. You can't even, we aren't even writing laws to actually match the world as it exists right now. We're going to the Supreme Court to decide on a case based on precedent from over 100 years ago. So the entire Supreme Court argument are like, I don't even know how to explain it. It's like we're arguing about laws that were made to deal with laws that don't exist anymore. Okay, so here's the thing. In the 1800s, there was naturalization in America was exclusively available for white Europeans. Those are the only people that could be naturalized as citizens. So the case they're talking about in the Supreme Court today, or at least they make reference to these cases, is like, okay, but you have a Chinese guy that comes over here and is, for all intents and purposes, a citizen. He's lived here his whole life. He's moved his whole family over here. He's made himself an American in every way he possibly can, except for, you know, blood and race. But our Constitution, as it existed then, didn't have provisions for a Chinese guy to become American. It just didn't exist. And so they wrote this law in the 14th Amendment to be, or, you know, at least part of it was about this idea of like, all right, well, you can't naturalize him because he's not white. So, but if he lives here and this is his domicile, then maybe we can make a provision for him. And so it's like the whole reason the 14th Amendment exists is to deal with people that are excluded by a naturalization law exclusive to Europeans that doesn't exist anymore. So we got rid of the naturalization law that meant the 14th Amendment was necessary, but we still have the 14th Amendment, even though that law doesn't exist anymore. This is the type of stuff that it's like, what are we doing? And like half of the conversation is them debating on the definition of words as understood by people in the 1800s. Again, I understand that it's like, okay, you set precedent and then you have to interpret the law. And as time changes, you have to go back and say, okay, does this word still mean the thing that it used to mean? If not, how do we update it? I understand. But it just seems ridiculous to me. It just seems, I mean, in fact, it is ridiculous. What should have happened a long time ago is that the 14th Amendment should have been eradicated and there should be a new law by Congress. Congress should write a new law that just says, hey, guys, to be an American citizen, one of your parents has to be an American citizen. That's the law, problem solved. That would be it. With no more discussion, no more conversation, no more debating, no more getting out a dictionary from 1806 to determine what exactly they meant by allegiance. Like, what if you just wrote a law in Congress that said the 14th Amendment is no longer applicable? We're not going to do it anymore. We don't need it. It's not, it literally is not necessary. It doesn't comport itself with the modern world. So we have to get rid of it. We have to change it. Instead, we're trying to go back in time and ascertain what the people who wrote it thought, even though obviously the world and its conditions as it exists now, if they could have foreseen what was to come, they didn't want any of this stuff to happen. They wouldn't be okay with any of this. I mean, the you know, really amazing example that's come out over the last couple of weeks is this island in Guam where you have thousands of Chinese moms giving birth to quote-unquote American babies. You tell me, like, just tell me if you can figure out the answer to this question. If you were to go back to 1868, when Chinese people were still slave workers building railroads in the Midwest, and ask the people who wrote the 14th Amendment, is the thing that you're writing right now, does it mean that if a Chinese woman goes to an island on Guam and then back in China, that baby is American? Do you really, like, is there any question that those people would be like, well, it's a complicated issue. I understand that. It's like, they'd be like, what? No. What is Guam? What are you talking about? Absolutely not. Is that what people think that we're writing? We need to really be more explicit here. Like, and that's another part of it. I think also genuinely the people in the past, they wrote things with the assumption that like the character of the nation would continue. And this is one of the, I don't know, misfires of Thomas Jefferson. See, Thomas Jefferson thought that the morals and the construct or what, that the people would stay the same. Sorry, it's a little confusing. I'm messing it up. Thomas Jefferson basically said that like every 20 years there would have to be a new government because they understood that they were trying to make a government that would have to change and operate in time with emerging technology and emerging just the modern world. They knew that like they couldn't write something that could go unchanged, right? It would have to change, and it might have to change completely. Like Thomas Jefferson straight up thought like, yeah, maybe in 20 years we just destroy the Constitution and start over with something new. They thought that the mode of government and the function of government would change, but that the people would stay the same more or less and just have to change government to fit with the modern times. The opposite has happened. We have sort of calcified our government structure into a form that just does not make sense anymore, while the world and everybody in America has changed entirely and like doesn't even have a theory of mind for what the founders were like how they thought and what their opinions were on things. And so, you know, in the 1860s, when the 14th Amendment was being written, you know, they wrote it just not thinking that they would have to explain these things. Like, they could not have guessed that there would be these subversive infiltrators 200 years later That would be twisting their words beyond recognition. They wrote it in, what's the phrase? It's like, good effort. You know, we need a revolution every 20 years just to keep the government honest. Like, that's what Thomas Jefferson thought. And yet, the government that he created is still operating 250 years later. It wasn't supposed to, guys. We were supposed to change this. We should change this. This doesn't make any sense, especially when you have people like Ketanji Brown Jackson making an absolute fool of herself. And I have a series of clips. I clipped them out myself, so it's not just stuff downloaded from the internet. And it's a series, and it's basically one chunk, but I cut it up into four pieces because each time it's Ketanji Brown Jackson bringing something up. And this is the thing. From Ketanji Brown Jackson's point of view, she's going into the record. She's going into the debates that happened because we have the records of the debates, exactly what was said. There's we don't need to speculate about if these people thought that they were writing a law to allow 10 million Mexicans to have free citizenship as long as they break our laws first. Like, this is ridiculous. But she's going back and she's not looking at it in good faith. That was the term I was looking for. She's not looking at it in good faith and going, I want to figure out what they really meant here. She's looking for little isolated, out of context phrases that she can dislocate from the rest of the conversation and use to build her, you know, straw man argument. It's like, is this what a Supreme Court justice is supposed to do? Instead of just like actually genuinely trying to understand what the people who were writing it actually meant so you can best enforce the law. She's literally just like, she knows that it's not the law, that the way she interprets it is not the way they interpreted it. And so she's deliberately misconstruing statements from the debate. And so this is a series where she brings something up, the lawyer for the government arguing against birthright citizenship just smacks her down like so perfectly. It's insane. And it's very funny because she interrupts him every time. Every time she's like, well, what about this? And he's like, yeah, that actually is in our faith. That's actually arguing for us. And you see, and she's like, well, okay, well, that may be so, but what about this over here? And he's like, yeah, that also is evidence of our argument is right. She's like, well, okay, well, that may be, let's not talk about that anymore. Let's move on to this next thing. Like, it's so embarrassing. I would think if these people had shame, they would be so embarrassed, but they don't. So we'll just have to talk about it and mock them regardless of how they feel. Let's go to clip 53 first. So this is Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson asking about the debate in 1868 and being told by the lawyer for the government, yeah, you are completely misinterpreting that. This entirely goes towards our argument, not yours. And then she interrupts him and cuts him off. Let's watch.
But if the Supreme Court had, prior to the 14th Amendment, established that allegiance meant the common law definition, I think your first hurdle is to help us understand why we would believe that when the 14th Amendment was ratified, the framers weren't just incorporating what we had previously said it meant.
Page 572 of the Congressional Record directly addresses this. They say the concept of temporary and local allegiance from the Schooner Exchange is what is meant by, or temporary and local jurisdiction from the Schooner Exchange is what is meant by the word jurisdiction in the 14th Amendment. Senator Trumbull says, I thought about saying owing allegiance, but again, quote, there's a sort of allegiance from persons temporarily resident in the United States whom we have no right to make citizens. So he expressly and consciously.
Okay, well.
She's like, well, what about this? He's like, this person expressly and deliberately says you're wrong. She's like, okay, we'll move on to the next point here. And this happens four times in a row, just like this. Okay, so let's go to the next one. I gotta figure out which one the next one here is. The argument supports us. Yeah, so this is the one where, again, she tries to bring something up that she has cherry-picked and isolated and said, well, if you take this out of context and read it through a modern lens, then it kind of seems like the guys that wrote this might be on our side. And the guy's like, no. If you take it in context, they literally debate the point that Ketanji Brown Jackson is making and decide that she's wrong back in 1868. And she should know this because she read it, but she's deliberately ignoring or being deliberately ignorant of the reality of the conversation that was happening and claiming that, you know, trying to take something out of context to frame it as if the framers of the 14th Amendment actually considered this. Like, she's just lying, and she again gets totally smacked down. Clip 54.
I mean, that's a debate and it's a discussion, very valid. But then we have a subsequent debate.
Sorry, I got to pause it there. Because again, all these clips are one after another, right? So the last clip that you just heard that just ended when he's like, yeah, no, this expressly says that you're wrong. She's like, but that's a debate. Okay, we can have that debate. It's not a debate, lady. So sorry, I think it's funny that she's just perfectly diametrically wrong, proven wrong. And she's like, well, that's a debate. It's not a debate. Sorry, back to the idiot.
I mean, that's a debate and it's a discussion, very valid. But then we have a subsequent debate between Fessenden and Wade, where the same concept comes up and it becomes clear, at least from Senator Wade's perspective, that that's wrong. So Fessenden, and I'm not sure whether these are senators, I apologize. Fessenden says, suppose a person is born here of parents from abroad temporarily in this country. Wade responds, the senator says a person may be born here and not be a citizen. I know that is so in one instance, in the case of the children of foreign ministers who reside near the United States, et cetera, et cetera. So it appears as though in that exchange, at least Senator Wade believed that the English common law understanding of what it means to have allegiance, to be a temporary person on the soil, was what was being adopted.
Yeah, that exchange strongly supports us. If you look at it in context, Senator Wade has introduced a version that says only birth on U.S. soil and doesn't have any allegiance or jurisdictional element to it. And so Senator Fessenden stands up and says, well, that can't be right because, you know, obviously, what about the children of temporary visitors? It has this, you know, it's another one of these statements that has this appeal to a background understanding that we all agree that the temporary visitors, their children do not become citizens. And then Senator Wade has to kind of backtrack and say, well, what are the children of ambassadors? And in the end, Congress does not adopt Senator Wade's proposal. So we think that to the extent you can draw an inference from that, the inference strongly supports.
All right.
Okay. All right. So I was totally wrong about that. And it actually supports your argument. Okay. Well, that's interesting. Yeah. Duh. So again, she's making a point. Taking one sentence or whatever out of a debate, you know, one exchange, and it's like, yeah, but that exchange ended with them making the conclusion that you're wrong. And basically, it's like originally they were debating, should it just be anybody born here? And they're like, no, that's ridiculous, because what if you have an invading army? Are all of their kids citizens? That's ridiculous. What if you have an ambassador that's just visiting here? Their kid's not going to be a citizen. Temporary visitor, somebody just passing through, they're not going to get us. So it has to be more than just having been born here. They have to be permanent residents here. They have to domicile here, meaning it's their permanent home. They have no plans on leaving. And that's where Ketanji Brown Jackson gets really confused and starts debating whether or not babies can have allegiances. Again, this is like, go back to 1868. And when they're sitting there, you know, in their smoke-filled rooms and their tuxedos and their top hats and beards, and they're going, you know, well, clearly, if it's somebody with an allegiance to another country, if you were to go back and be like, is it the baby's allegiance? Like, what? Do we need to write? No, babies don't have allegiances. Like, what are you talking about? How could this possibly have been what they intended? It's the millennial woes, retweeted text that people post all the time. They just pretend to be stupid. They pretend not to understand. This is obvious. It's not the baby's allegiance that's at question. It's the parents' allegiance that's at question. So this was the next question, Ketanji Brown Jackson. That's two in a row. Two things she brings up that just get immediately smacked down with the primary sources by the government. We'll move on to the next part. Do babies have allegiances? And it's like, okay, great. Supreme Court of the United States. Let's watch clip number 55.
Well, let me just ask you about why we wouldn't see in the 14th Amendment anything about parental allegiance. Several of my colleagues have talked about the fact that your view of this turns on what the status of the parents are and not the child, as would the born in the United States view of it. Can you help us understand why we wouldn't expect to see a mention of parents in the text of this amendment?
I think it was well understood that, for example, children cannot, you know, newborns cannot form domicile. So it followed every 19th century.
That assumes domicile is in the test. And I'm asking you, how do we know that Congress did adopt the test that you say it adopted?
Yeah, when you're looking at 19th century conceptions of allegiance, the notion that the allegiance, again, you say domicile is instantiating the concept of allegiance for aliens as opposed to citizen. All of that, the 19th century understands the newborn's domicile, its allegiance follows the allegiance of the parents. And I point out that their theory relies on parental allegiance as well, because they recognize the exceptions for, you know, hostile invading armies, for tribal Indians, for ambassadors. Again, the child's allegiance status, even on their view, all turns right, on the status of the parent.
Yeah, yeah, okay, all right. Babies don't have allegiances. I'm keeping up with you there. The hell are you talking about? What are you talking about? And like, this gets absurd. Amy Comey Barrett asked a question, what happens if we don't know who the kid's parents are? It's like, I don't know. How is that even possible? You know that they were born in the United States, but you don't know who their mother is? How could that even occur? Are you trying to write a law that can somehow also contain within it potentialities that literally cannot exist? Like, why would the law need to say that if we don't know who the parents are? Tell you what. If ever there is a baby born for which we don't even know who their parents are, but they're born in America and we see them being born somehow without knowing who their parents are. Tell you what, in that case, yeah, sure, that kid can be a citizen. I'm willing to make that little caveat there, just in case there's any sort of spontaneous manifestation of babies. They get to be American citizens. There's some sort of beyond miraculous conception, miraculous delivery with no mother. It's, yeah, okay, that the miracle baby gets to be American. I'm okay with that. Why are we talking about this? What the hell are we doing? How is this the United States of America in the year 2026? Let's go to the next one. Let's go to, again, she can't understand that it's deliberately misunderstanding, being deliberately ignorant, and it's so infuriating that this is the way that the future of our republic is being litigated. Let's watch.
We're supposed to do this. Don't worry about the people who are already here and who would not qualify under your rule. How does this work? Are you suggesting that when a baby is born, people have to have documents, present documents? Is this happening in the delivery room? How are we determining when or whether a newborn child is a citizen of the United States under your rule?
And I think that's directly addressed in the SSA guidance that's cited in our brief. What SSA says is there's currently a system where, for example, Social Security numbers are generated based on the birth certificate. They say this can still be, for the vast majority of instances, completely transparent. You will still get a...
transparent. I'm just talking about the particulars, because now you say your rule turns on whether the person intended to stay in the United States. And I think Justice Barrett brought this up. So are we bringing pregnant women in for depositions? What are we doing to figure this out?
No, as I pointed out earlier, the executive order turns on lawfulness of status. So if you give birth to a baby in the hospital right now, it gets the birth certificate in the system. There's a computer system.
So there's no opportunity. There's apparently no opportunity then for the person to prove or to say that they actually intended to stay in the United States.
Absolutely not. The opposite is true. Their opportunity to dispute if they think they were wrongly denied, which would only happen in a tiny minority of cases, is directly addressed in that guidance.
After the fact.
Yes.
After their baby has been denied citizenship, then we can go through the process.
Yes. And the way that, I mean, I'm summarizing because I'm not an expert in computers, but there's a computer program that currently automatically generates a Social Security number. SSA says, look, a Social Security number, non-citizens can have them if they have work authorization, so it doesn't prove citizenship. We'll give you a Social Security number, provided that there's the system automatically checks the immigration status of the parents, which there are robust databases for, and then it appears no different to the vast majority of birthing parents.
So again, I genuinely don't even understand what she was asking. What? She's like, oh, so we're going to be deposing pregnant women? What are you talking about? If they're a legal citizen here to stay because they're on a permanent visa, then they're domiciled here. Like, this is not complicated. They're literally creating non-existent circumstances to try to come up with a reason to oppose this. This whole thing is absurd. This shouldn't even be at the Supreme Court. If they actually decide, in favor of birthright citizenship, that's basically it for the country. I'll show you one more clip on the other side in the first 5-minute small segment that really shows you how broken and lost and in need of replacement our system is. And then Royce White joins me to talk about the Antichrist activity. Ladies and gentlemen, you know the power of turmeric, but have you felt it? Have you tried the ultimate turmeric gummies, the delicious way to harness the ancient power of golden turmeric, supercharged with ginger root and black pepper for maximum impact? Each gummy delivers 125 milligrams of premium turmeric extract packed with curcumin, the clinically studied compound shown to support healthy inflammation response, ease everyday aches, and promote joint comfort so you can move through life with ease. We added real ginger root, trusted for centuries to calm digestion and soothe the stomach, plus a precise dose of black pepper extract with pepperine, proven to boost curcumin absorption by up to 2,000%. That means more of the good stuff actually gets where your body needs it. No capsules, no bitter aftertaste, just one tasty tropical-flavored gummy a day, or two if you're feeling extra, to help you feel lighter, looser, and more energized. Ultimate Turmeric Gummies, ancient wisdom meets modern science in the best-tasting form possible. Grab yours today and start feeling the ultimate difference in health. With Ultimate Turmeric Gummies, inflammation doesn't stand a chance. Get yours today at the Alex Jones Store